Hi, my name is Angela and I'll be your chair for this session. So just to confirm, we're in room B for the presentation on premium regulation in privatised accident compensation schemes. To introduce our speaker, Bevan Dam. Bevan is a director at Ernst & Young. He is a qualified actuary and has worked in the insurance industry for almost a decade, spanning both general insurance and health insurance, currently holding an appointed actuary role. Bevan provides key input to the New South Wales CTP market through the scheme actuary role Ernst & Young holds with the MAA. And prior to this, Bevan managed scheme liability valuations and scheme reviews for workers for WorkCover New South Wales. So Bevan will be doing the presentation today, and Andrew Doman was meant to be here as well, but I think he's busy with something. So please welcome Bevan to the stage.
Okay, thanks for coming along to listen to what I've got to say this morning. I'll give a little bit of a background about premium regulation and why we're talking about premium regulation in privatised schemes. It's a fairly narrow type of topic to talk about. I'll give a brief survey of some of the schemes and characteristics, some of the options and some of the common themes that we see when we look across, and also then just a brief summary about where we've gotten to. So what makes accident compensation unique? First of all, it's compulsory to buy. Second of all, typically it's compulsory to sell. If it's not compulsory to sell, then usually there's some mechanism that allows a purchaser to be able to buy it, even if the free market is not offering it to them. So what we see is motor vehicle owners and employers, our laws in Australia and almost all around the world require people to purchase before you can drive a car on the road or before you can run a business. Texas is an exception to the workers' comp around that, but typically they're also liable to the common law elements. So there's coverage, but unless you're large enough, it makes sense that you should be buying such insurance. So because of these two compulsory elements, that really starts to drive how is the premium collected and what kind of design and incentives are involved in that process. So, second reason about why looking at premium regulation in a bit more depth. If we look around the country at the moment, there's five schemes who are doing some form of a review. So New South Wales WorkCover, that's pretty clear. They've gone through significant benefit reform and they've put a line into their legislation around the power to admit new insurers or other insurers particularly. That certainly opens up for privatisation, but it also allows for specialisation to come into the scheme. South Australia CDP, they've put out a green paper around third party and first party options, and part of that is around looking at affordability and fairness, which are two objectives that are typically competing. Third is New South Wales CDP, who are going through a pricing strategy review at the moment, and elements of that are market design and premium system. And if we look at Queensland WorkCover and also Comcare, we see similar kinds of activity occurring. So with Comcare, it's not stated, but a question there is privatisation on the agenda as well. If we look at a historical aspect, I guess we found this quite instructive to look back through history a bit more. And in 1913, there was an Ontario Workers' Compensation Report out, Meredith Report it was called. It took 3 years for it to be developed and went through a few different drafts and also commented on the legislation that, first of all, it had recommended, and then the politicians took control of that process, and then it made comments around the changes that the politicians had made. But in essence, there were agreed principles across all of the investigation of that review, and that was, and this is from a workers' comp perspective clearly, injury and disease should be compensated, and there was no real argument about that, and the industry should pay for its own costs in essence. And there was no real argument about that. But there were differences of opinion about how the detail of that should be built. And this was in 1913. And what we see is we're still discussing some of those issues today, and we still don't have solutions that everyone agrees with today. Now, not all of this relates directly to premium regulation, but premium regulation flows out of this. So one of the key issues they talked about back then was paid versus incurred. Clearly, it takes a long... If you're under a paid environment, it takes a long time for the liabilities to stabilise. Well, that's also driving the premiums. And what about the cross-subsidies? So you've got clear intergenerational cross-subsidies occurring across that arrangement. Back then, they had clear fear of political intervention, particularly in the premium rates. And we've seen an example of that over the last few years, where New South Wales WorkCover reduced premiums on a flat basis. And the effect that had on the equity of the tariff rates actually upsets the fairness of those rates. So there's issues there. And then contributory negligence was also being considered. So the proportioning of if someone was at fault, how much should they be getting, particularly if it's a first-party type arrangement, and also the moral hazard that's attached to that. And the final look at what they were considering in 1913 was, again, still grappling with some of these issues, but they weren't going to be removed. They were going to look at removing common law, but only once there was a satisfactory scheme in place where there was going to be adequate compensation. They were looking at, well, how do we put time limits on that that relate to whatever the durations of injury and disease were? And that also attributes to the moral hazard element of that. And then discussions of employers and government contributing to the administration of the expense base. And what that had to do is it was a recognition of the win-win of putting such schemes in place, and looking at the return to work elements of added productivity coming out of that. So when we review across different scheme designs around the premium elements, what we come to see is quite a common approach to the scheme. So first of all, there's a tariff, a base tariff of some description. Then there's some element of experience rating. And then for certain circumstances, there's a carve-out of, well, you have enough experience, or you have enough body of knowledge and enough employers, for example, that you can operate your own miniature scheme over here. So if we look in a bit more detail around the tariffs, we have community rating. So there's a range of community rating that we see across Australia. And I guess working in health insurance, community rating is kind of the terminology that's used. And I know it's not typically used in accident compensation, but there's certain elements that you can certainly bring across industries to think about it differently. What community rating does, though, it creates cross-subsidies across the different areas of the community where you're actually flat rating. If there's sufficient experience, then we can then look at putting some experience rating element into that. So what's that mean? If there's enough... I guess we use the term credibility, but if there's enough experience, then we can allow the experience of either the employer or the group of employers or the car drivers to come through in a cap floor arrangement or bonus malus arrangement, and we see both of those in practice in Australia at the moment. We've also got differing periods of when that experience should come in, how many years of experience should be counted, from 1 year in a retro burner type approach to a multi-year experience rating. And then finally, if size is significant enough, then we've got elements of self-insurance and specialised that can come into play. And they may be built around the same rules as the tariff and the experience rating system, but carved out as a group. So in essence, I guess specialisation is coming to the fore in New South Wales at the moment because of the change in legislation. And what does it mean for groups who are interested in that? We've talked to a few different stakeholders across the schemes in New South Wales, and some of the employment groups have a view about specialisation, and that's around getting their own control as an industry and operating the insurance element like a small business, so that there's more direct relationship between what's going on in the insurance space and then what they see coming out in their premiums as well, and giving them a better service approach. And that was certainly an element that came through in the interviews that we did. So ultimately, it's about trying to provide better signals to employers and car drivers in some way, while trying to be fair at the same time. If we look across the spectrum of what kinds of scheme designs that we see around Australia particularly, and this has been put forward in a number of different guises. 2004 Productivity Commission had a version of Michael Playford, I think I saw him in the room, a version of this. And I've taken some of that, but I've modified it, I guess, with our agenda in mind particularly, where you've got the centralised and you've got a mixed model, and then you've got the open model, which is around the privatisation or the privatised element, and what does that bring? And within that, we'll then explore some of those elements. But I guess there's also a private element sitting over on the bottom left-hand side, which is around private monopolies. And to an extent, we can see New South Wales Coal Services is an example of that. But also self-insurers and specialised insurers would also be examples of that, where they've got a monopoly of the business, but they're also private. So if we look at some of the premium settings around the private underwriting arrangements, from a more to a least regulated, and I guess it should be fairly obvious that the schemes that these are taken from are Queensland CDP firstly. So what do we see there? We see class rated, then risk rated by a cap and floor approach. But what do we see in practice? What we see is typically writing at the ceiling, so at the upper limit, and what that's doing is limiting competition in that scheme. So in that sense, distribution becomes critical for an insurer to be making money in that business. In a less regulated environment, so an example would be New South Wales CDP, we see class and then some geographic element into the rating, and then risk rated by bonus malus structure. Not dissimilar, but there are some differences. And what we see here is we see writing businesses at both bonus and malus levels. So that indicates there is some better competition occurring in that space. The file and write that's associated with that, that's providing regulatory oversight as well, and that's ensuring that there's some value, whether it's affordability or whether it's equity, that's being put into those premiums as they're being done. So distribution here is still important because you've still got significant cross-subsidies occurring within the schemes. And then if we look at an example, Western Australia Workers' Comp, where I've called that the least regulated. There are probably other examples of pure risk rating, and their arrangement is based on ANZIC recommended rates, and then there's any discount as low as the insurer would like to write, and also limited loadings, but they can be raised with due reason. So what we see there is what we might call full competition occurring, and particularly if we look at the premiums, they're quite stable, give or take 10% per annum variation, which is less than we see some groups move around in other schemes. So if we look at some of the key characteristics that we see in premium design, what's the nature of the scheme? Who are the beneficiaries and who are the funders? So the beneficiaries typically are employees and road users, and the funders are employers and the drivers. So then it becomes, well, how do you actually, what's the best way of getting money from the funders? What's the fairest or most affordable way without putting some of those offside? And then you've got to look at the nature of the risks. So high volume versus a low volume. Low volume is CDP. So then it makes it harder to group some of those... you have to group more of the premium groups together in CDP because of the much lower volume. You can't really get a good frequency information from this, the more granular funders of that arrangement, whereas workers' compensation, the volumes typically are higher, and so you can get a better sense of more appropriate risk pricing from that. We have data availability and quality issues to deal with. So we've got scarcity of data, how many cells do you end up having and how much data is in some of those cells at the bottom of the trees. What about when you're introducing new data into the scheme? You've created either new rating factors that you're wanting to use or that you should be using and you haven't been collecting that data. How long do you need to do it and how do you write it in the meantime? And then finally, if we look briefly at the incentives, what incentives are there in the scheme, and particularly how can you create some of those incentives into the premium side of things? So you've got, from an OHS perspective, that's a commercial incentive for employers, clearly. From a moral hazard perspective and also penalties for negligence, CDP is much harder to create incentives in. And so really, some of those incentives around CDP are sitting outside of the premium system and are sitting in the law element or in the decision between a first and a third party. If we look in a little bit more detail around the workers' compensation options, and we'll see some of these coming in commonality with CDP as well, typically we've got centrally set premiums with cross-subsidisations, and now whether they're deliberate across geographies or not, and what are the limitations around system constraints that allow you to remove some of those cross-subsidies. Risk pooling becomes an option, and I'll talk a little bit more about that as an option for both types of schemes as well. And it doesn't really get used in Australia much. It's used in health insurance and it's used overseas, so talk about some ways and reasons of using that. We've got caps and floor allowances, and that gives protection for poor experience. So what we find is there's systems can be too sensitive to smaller or mid-sized employers, and so there's a fairness element that you need to put into your premium system, and it may not be in the numerics, but it may actually just be in the rules and the guides that you're using for writing the premiums and the rules that the insurers have to use. And of course then, how low can you go in the granularity of risks? How far down the ANZAC trees can you go before the scarcity becomes an issue again? Scarcity of data. So we see very similar kinds of options around CDP. And really the two run in parallel, and then there are many elements that are common, but there are key differences, and that's really where all the differences between the schemes seem to drive different outcomes and behaviours. So if we look at the New South Wales CDP arrangement, there's a setting of the relativities and setting of the region and classes. But then there's an allowance for some movement between levels where the insurers want to pick up the better risks or the worse, or limit their exposure to the poorer risks. There's also a limitation around the risk factors that are used, and what that tends to do is create less innovation in the rating system and less innovation in optimising how insurers can make profits out of that. If we look at the granularity of risk, there's more in CDP there seems to be more openness to having a more granular application of some of those risks. And I've listed a few there, and also gender is obviously another element that can be brought into that as well. But more typically driving history and age. Age is really a key factor that doesn't always get used in the rating, or it may have restrictions put on it by the regulator. So the common issues that we see coming out of that is that what is the role of the regulator in administering the scheme? Have they been part of the putting the overarching principles together, or are they really fleshing out the direction that the government's given them? So what's their framework for approving or rejecting premiums if there's a premium approval process? What's the application of the relevant levies? So there's regulated costs, there's nominal insured costs if you've got that element in there. But there's also, more particularly at the moment, NIIS coming through, and where does that sit, and how might that be levied into this? Less of an issue is NDIS, although NDIS and the schemes will be competing for the same resources to run the back end of their processes, the claims processes. So we've typically got LTCS as a model that we can use for that, at least as a basis to look at, well, how does funding work and how might it work in the future? If you look at the premium setting methods, we've got cross subsidies occurring throughout the premiums. And again, that comes down to if we haven't got enough granularity, then we end up with cross subsidies. And it's that may be what the government is looking for, so that there's parts of society that, even though they're much higher risk, then they're not having to pay that, even though they... So that comes down to an affordability issue. So from that perspective... is there independence in the rate setting process and independence from the regulator, or is the regulator being controlled to an extent by the government? And the final element that I'll draw on is around the competition incentives that are that's in the premium structure and the premium system. And how does that affect the market behaviour of the insurers? So naturally, insurers would be wanting to avoid risk where they can't price it appropriately. And to an extent, there's a fully funding test that's in New South Wales that prevents them from putting too low a risk in, and also prevents it from upsetting the competitive nature of the scheme in New South Wales. I mentioned a few times around risk pooling arrangements, and it's not commonly used in Australia, but there are ways to use risk pooling to allow or to get out from under the cross-subsidisation issues. So if you've got cross-subsidisation occurring, what you've got is, for example, insurer one is writing good risks, and insurer one's writing good risks and every other insurer may be writing better risks, and insurer two, for whatever reason, may be writing poor risks. So how do you then incentivise the insurers to be providing better service to the community, for example? Because what that's doing is somehow insurer one and insurer two have access to different distribution methods. And so as a result... insurer two, even though it's being forced to write, it's got a distribution approach which is feeding it poor risks. So to ensure that there's some level of competition, then a risk pooling arrangement can happen where insurer one and all the other insurers are actually subsidising insurer two. So an example would be Queensland CDP, where there appears to be limited competition. Some kind of arrangement like this might actually see some of the prices change once you see the disincentive for writing those poor risks removed. More from a work cover perspective, on the right-hand side, you've got where there's no requirement to quote or to write the business. Then you've got typically insurer one and insurer two maybe actually rejecting risks or putting the price up too high. Then there's an insurer of last resort that maybe either a private insurer that's managing that for the government or for the regulator, who then is subsidised. So they're writing the business at a lower than the risk price, and then all the other insurers in the market are funding that. And that would allow that the insurer of last resort to be fully funded and the schemes overall to be appropriately priced. So the key challenges we see, there's essentially two stakeholders in these kinds of arrangements, and that's the claimants and the funders. And there's essentially a set of providers. Now, the insurers are a specific special type of provider, but they're not necessarily one of the stakeholders who is receiving something out of the scheme or providing into the scheme in that arrangement. And then there's all the other providers who aren't really putting any risk into the arrangement. So there's the medical providers, the claim service providers. And if we then look at what's the mindsets of the insurers and the regulators, the insurers ultimately are looking to protect their existing business models that work. And so what they're trying to minimise is the political interference on the premium rates, and also looking to have some form of a cooperative arrangement and an arrangement where they're working with competent regulators as well. So the benefit system is also attempting to result in stable premiums. But what we also see is the fully funded test is to an extent at odds with that. What it's actually doing is when there's a downturn in experience, it's actually forcing the prices up, which is creating instability in that system as well. So ultimately, we come back to the same principle of it's equity and affordability that we're looking for, but those two are competing. If we look at an example that's working reasonably well, it would be Western Australia Workers' Comp System, which appears to be providing stable premiums in the longer term. If we look at what are some scheme improvements that could be used for existing schemes, we're aiming for how do we create insurers' potential for profit so that there's an incentive to invest further into these businesses. So what new features can be brought in, but at the same time those features create issues when they do come in. So more granularity in the pricing, of course, creates instability in that pricing. If there's fully risk rating occurring, then that also creates the potential for underinsurance. And also, and finally, some would argue that if you introduce risk pooling, then that removes some of the innovation that the insurers have been developing around the current systems. So that comes back to insurers like their existing business model and need to be able to see how they can make money in a new business model as well for them to be more accepting of that. So if I briefly summarise, the elements that we have drawn out of our review of the schemes and the review of the premium arrangements that we've seen across Australia and some international arrangements. Affordability and fairness are the overarching elements that need to be brought to bear, but the issue is they're in continuous conflict. What we also see is that multiple approaches can work, and pretty much most designs typically work. They do require strong management of those designs to work, though, because that's really a continuous compensation of the other inadequacies around the competing objectives. And what we also see is that the flavour of the schemes typically tends to have a jurisdictional or a cultural element to it. So when we look around overseas, what we see is the types and effectiveness of the schemes, while it's mixed, it tends to be, to an extent, along the lines of historical political biases in those jurisdictions. So one way of summarising, well, what's the best option around premiums is actually to look at the system that best suits your own society's needs and then to implement that. So that's the end of my presentation. Happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
So I'll also invite Andrew to come to the front to join us for the question session. Also, just to remind you, we've got a microphone in the middle of the room. So if you've got a question, please go up there and speak into the mic because we're recording this session. And please say your name and company as well.
John Morgan from Allens, a lawyer, not an actuary. The history of CTP in New South Wales, and I think it's the history of the other schemes, has been that the issues of premium have more often than not been dealt with by changes in benefit design. And that raises a different dimension of fairness, which I don't think is really getting enough discussion. If you look, to take an example, the Bob Carr reduction of $100 out of New South Wales CTP was really achieved by changes in benefit design. I just wonder what comments you've got about that and whether you see... does that have to be resolved at a political level, or you think the insurers and their advisors really have a significant role in that issue and the debate about fairness?
I guess there's several ways I could look at that question. One is that you've indicated that they've looked at benefit changes as the way of delivering the savings through the premium.
No, it's rather than putting the pressure on a discussion about premium, it becomes a discussion about benefit design, and therefore we get savings out of benefits, therefore the premium comes down, rather than trying to focus on how can we make insurers more efficient and how we incentivise them to pass on those efficiencies in what are fairly much small markets. Well, small number of insurance, oligarchies.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, that's not right.
So that an element of what we were... an element of the research was actually around looking at the premiums specifically, knowing that, well, the benefits is one half of that, but how do you actually fund it? And how do you keep that fair? And how do you try and keep that affordable at the same time? And so to an extent, there's an element of the risk pooling arrangement that can facilitate that. But there might be other elements that the government or the regulator has actually put in place, whether knowingly or not, that are actually creating inefficiencies around the premium side of it. So I guess that's where our focus has been a bit more.
Yeah. I just don't think you can have this discussion on a one-dimensional basis. You've got to have a discussion of the dynamics between benefit design and premium. and because the two just interact so intimately, and I think that's the history of what's happened in a lot of schemes.
Yeah, look, John, I agree with you. Like, you can't sort of talk about premiums and not benefits because they're just so interrelated. One thing to answer your question, yeah, I do believe there's a role for insurers to educate either whether it's be the regulator or the government in terms of what types of benefit designs can lead to more stable premiums and lead to better, I guess, outcomes for premiums and how they sort of interact. So I agree with you on that perspective. I guess this presentation was more sort of taking one element out of what our stakeholder interviews were about and sort of drawing upon that. So it's not necessarily saying that premiums and benefits, you can consider them in isolation. Does that...
Yeah, well, I don't think they can be considered in isolation. I think that you've got to have this debate having regard to the dynamic interaction between the benefit design issue, the changes in benefit outcomes and premiums. Mm. And there's another dynamic, which is how do you get efficiencies passed on, which I think is the big challenge in the S schemes. How do you create the efficiencies and how do you get them passed on? And that's got to somehow appear in the design of the scheme and the premium system.
I guess in terms of getting the... what we're seeing in a lot of the schemes today is that there's a lot of cases where there's benefits that pretty much, you know, the payers don't want to pay for, so there needs to be some sort of scheme review or something done about that to get that right, get the right interaction between the benefits and the premiums. In terms of the efficiency, I guess the way practically we achieve that is by standardising the product and then having some form of either rate filing or some kind of benchmarking for the insurers to then price against or to work within, and then they compete against each other and achieve those kind of efficiencies. That's the way we've seen things work, and draws a bit more transparency on how much profit are you getting, how much are your expenses, how much is your claims cost, and how does that all interact within your premiums. Do you have any...
Actually, Bevan and Andrew, I've got a question for you. So in the last plenary, we heard Andrew Nichols talk about, insurers using price and supply to control the business. So, you know, like where if you've got like, for high risk, they would use price to push it up in a compulsory scheme, for example. So in your opinion, for the high risks, in order to support affordability, who should be funding the cost of those high risks?
Well, that's really the dilemma, I guess, that we're trying to explore. As a whole, society needs to be funding them somehow. And if those risk holders aren't funding, so if young people are underinsuring, ultimately the nominal insurer concept has to be paid for and all the other people who are funding. So at some level, why don't you lower the price that those high-risk people have to pay so that at least you're getting them to be insured and they are paying some of their way instead of none of their way if that arrangement wasn't in place. But, yes, that is the dilemma between affordability and equity. Who should pay and how does society want to deal with that as a whole?
Okay, if there aren't any further questions, I think we might wrap up there. Small gift from the Institute to our speakers. Thank you, Bevan.
Thanks, Andrew.